All right, I don't think I can do this presentation after the two prior speakers. John's presentation, I thought, was extremely comprehensive, talked so much about federal Superfund, which is actually quite similar in many ways to the state Superfund, although I would suggest we've got more successes. I got a kick out of John's presentation. It's from Rockets to Bunnies to Superfund. And I get a little bit of a kick of myself there. I was leaning on a chair back there, and at just the right time, I asked the question of how much, and I ended up looking at the sky. Didn't miss a beat, though. Anyhow, I'm going to talk about some of the same kind of things they do, but go mostly to the point of view of the legislation coming about. So John and Steve did a good backup on that. I'll do a little bit more of some of that stuff, but mostly move on. Okay, the first slide I have here is talking about Love Canal in a certain kind of way here. Love Canal was a particularly awful kind of site, as John described it. There was people actually living on top of it. I can't think of a site that we had that was quite that bad, but we had a number of sites that I call our mini Love Canals, and they ended up resulting in the legislation that became Minnesota Superfund. In terms of the Love Canal, you know, there was great concern, there was fear that was associated with, that there was upset people, there was exposure to chemicals. And on a number of our sites, we had similar kind of things, if not as obscene as in the case of the Love Canal. One of the sites I wanted to zero in on, actually two sites I wanted to mention, that were big impetuses for the start of our program and for later the legislative action. It was Oakdale and Ironwood. And to give you some kind of feeling for what we did in terms of investigations at sites, I'll go through Oakdale a little bit, the early stages. Oakdale was a site that, as Steve mentioned, Jerry Stonkey, who's probably here somewhere today. There's Jerry. Jerry was one of the people who worked in our open dump inventory and also an inspector of solid waste facilities. He found this site in Oakdale, which had some pails on it, and he suspected it was a disposal site. Brought it to my attention, and myself and Mike Ayers, who predated the strike force in this kind of field of work, went out to the site. It's kind of interesting, you know, if you haven't seen a whole lot of these sites and if they're buried, you go out there and it actually looks quite pretty. It was a very large piece of property, several blocks on each side. It was wooded. It had a marsh and a lake in the middle. It had tons of ducks and wildlife about the place. We went onto the site, and we noticed some of these five-gallon pails, but it still looked kind of pretty. But then we went closer to the marsh, and where the soil slopes down to the marsh, we found there was layering of soil in there. So the whole site was really one that had been filled in from a swamp, marsh, to largely high and dry, you might say, plus the lake, a remnant left in the middle. And the layering on the slopes, you could see different colors in the soil. You could see metal in the soil like barrels. In this case, we found really a huge site that had many, many, many thousands of drums, largely of solvents in it. In terms of the investigation, I think it might be interesting to talk about how it was sort of a detective kind of thing that you did as an inspector there. So in this case, we went ahead and we saw and talked to people around the site. We talked to the MnDOT, who had put a highway through the north side of the site. We talked to XL Energy, who had put high transmission power lines on the site, etc., and found actually that there was people who knew about the site, and in the case of the construction that occurred, especially Excel, their logbook showed that their people had put the new transmission lines in at times using gas masks when they put them in. We also looked back at aerial photos, which have been around quite a while since, I don't know, World War II or after, and you could actually pick out this site on the aerial photos and semis coming in with drums. So that was real interesting there. Eventually, we also found some individuals who had lived there quite a while, and they pointed out some things that had happened in the past. One of the things they pointed out was that I think it was the Pioneer Press, had a large article on a huge fire that had occurred at that facility. So semis would come in with drums on them, And they were supposed to put those, take those drums off as soon as possible and bury them as soon as possible. The particular article in the Pioneer Press showed one of these semis on fire. The barrels hadn't been put in the ground quick enough. They had spontaneously combusted in some way. They ignited. And in that case, there actually was the person who was driving the truck had died in that fire and explosion. With time, though, we figured out who owned the site, where the waste came from largely. One of the major contributors was 3M. Actually, the major contributor to the site was 3M, no doubt about that. We did eventually work with 3M on that site, and they did an investigation and cleanup. So that was one example of how much how interesting it was to go ahead and do some of the work early on in the program, new ways of doing things. In addition, as it was mentioned by Steve and John, there was a tremendous amount of coverage of these kind of things, so the public was very aware, the media was very aware, and we were interviewed actually quite frequently by the media. Eventually, that coverage and all the commotion that came up there caused the institution of the strike force, as Steve has indicated. In addition to, let me just remind you, I missed something there. In the case of the Oakdale site, we got a call one day. Mike Ayers had been on the TV one evening and talking about the Oakdale site. They had taken photos of him out at the site itself. Next morning, we got a phone call that came in, and the person was calling was thanking us for the work we had done at the site and we had done to protect public health and the environment. It ended up that that was a direct phone call from Governor Cui, which was really pretty cool that he took the time out of his schedule to thank someone on the PCA who was just doing their job. In addition to the governor, there was legislators who were concerned. Many legislators had Superfund-type sites in their backyard. And in this case, I'm pointing out that Senator Merriam and Representative Munger, those two persons were the chairs of the environment committees, respectively, in the Senate and the House. And they had in their backyards actual sites that were, in some cases, pretty dang evident, and they were very concerned about it. They being in a position of, you know, power in terms of legislators, but especially the chairmen of those committees, was a very good thing for the passage of the program. So what happened was that we went ahead and we had legislative hearings and we had field meetings as well on a number of the sites. In the case of Senator Merriam, he had the Cecil Heidelberger site, which included somewhere near 1,000 drums of solvents above ground in full view, not to mention his few million tires, waste tires he had at his site. If any of you date back that far, you'll remember his tire site especially. In addition, we had actually a short distance, a fractional mile away, in Senator Merriam's area, we had the Waste Disposal Engineering Landfill, which is a facility that over decades was a sanitary landfill, but also accepted hazardous wastes, and probably made the Cecil Heidelberger site look like nothing in terms of the total amount of waste that had been buried at that site. In the case of Representative Munger, he's in the Duluth area. We had three sites that we showed to the legislature prior to their official indoor meetings, and we gave them a rundown on the Arrowhead refining site. We actually went out to the site. It's a site that re-refined waste oil, cleaned it up, and the black goop that was left was used to fill up a marsh. Almost looked like you could actually walk on it, but we didn't try that. Probably wouldn't be wise. In addition, there was two sites that were along Lake Superior, U.S. Steel, which by that time was no longer in use, was basically an abandoned site. And the same thing was true in terms of Interlake site, which was right there on the lake. And there was contamination at the site, the derelict facility, all kind of contamination at the site. And also you could see contamination in the water itself of Lake Superior. So we held these hearings there with the at the legislature and did those visits to the actual sites. I wasn't really involved very much in the legislation, pretty much close to zero, actually. We just did our job in terms of the strike force. But one of the big issues at the legislature was the idea of strict joint and several liability, which I think was alluded to perhaps by John a little bit. That means that anyone who's contributing to a site is responsible for 100% of the site. So if you've got three companies or 10 companies or 100, each one of them is fully responsible for the site. That makes some sense in that contamination from you, from me, et cetera, contributors, you know, mixes together, ends up that way in the site. But another piece that was really important was to be sure that we didn't get buried in trying to figure out how much from this person, how much from that company, and find ourselves in court from now until forever. So the strict joint and several liability was a pretty powerful tool for the Superfund. That was an issue that there was some disagreement between the leadership of 3M and the governor, and that was one of the hot items. I can't remember a whole lot that was otherwise hot about the Superfund idea. By that time, by the time it passed in 1983, Superfund was something that had to happen, and I think everybody understood that. There was some newspaper accounts that believed that 3M may have, as part of the reasons why they moved to Texas, might have been this dispute between the governor and 3M. In any case, it was passed. The Superfund was passed in 83, 3 years after the federal Superfund, but there had been a strike force in between and a lot of cooperation from some companies. Here are the people that I think are responsible for the Superfund being passed. Of course, Senator Merriam, Representative Munger. I think it would also be important to point out that Alan Williams was an attorney for the House Environment Committee. He drafted and redrafted the Superfund law, the Minnesota Superfund law, as it went through the process of the legislature. Another person who was very important was Mike Robertson. He was the assistant commissioner at that time at the PCA, and his job was to legislative liaison to move projects through the system. And last but not least, I'd indicate the strike force, I think, was a very important group. It found sites, it investigated them, did some cleanups of sites, and held numerous public meetings, difficult meetings, and so on. After the Superfund was passed, there was a question of implementation. How were we going to do this? And our commissioner, Sandy Gardebring, was a very good commissioner, but she had in her head initially that we would hire people, get the bulldozers moving, clean up all these sites there. But we had so many sites even at that early stage, and only so many dollars, that wouldn't work. And in addition, we had responsible parties who, according to this law, were supposed to do the work. So Gary Pulford and I, who were at the new program, the new Superfund program, pointed out to her what the statute said, pointed out that we had a number of responsible persons who were very cooperative and that they were, in fact, actually doing work already. So by the time State Superfund was passed, FMC had already done a gigantic excavation, and 3M was about to do their excavation as well. Anyhow, Sandy saw the value of going after the responsible parties and working with them where possible and still having that leverage of us being able to do the work or spend some money. Initially, what the Superfund looked like, we had about 24 staff. We had two units. One was a responsible party unit, and the purpose of that group was to find sites, find responsible parties, push them to do the right thing. And that was actually the bigger part of the program. The second unit was fund finance. That's where you used Superfund dollars to do cleanups, investigations and cleanups. And that was very important, too. But initially in the program, it was more so the RP side of things. I think also worth mentioning that we had a very good support from EPA. EPA Region 5 in particular, Rich Bartelt was the head of that program, and he provided dollars before our Superfund was passed to help us do investigations at a number of sites and in that big cleanup that Steve mentioned at Isanti. We quickly attempted to get quite a number of our sites on the federal Superfund because they although they didn't have enough money, as John said, it seemed like they had a huge amount of money potentially. And for a state, you wanted to go ahead and get as much of that as you could. I submitted the first 10 sites in Minnesota to the national priority list. And just an interesting number one score in the USA was the FMC site. And the reason for that was that the FMC site was affecting groundwater. Fridley Municipal Well was right next door. And was also affecting potentially the Minneapolis water intake. The groundwater was discharging to the surface water, the Mississippi River, and downstream was the Minneapolis water intake. So I ended up with a very high score, a 74. This was during a time when the federal government didn't care quite so much as they might about the environment, and FMC did go to the federal government, suggested that there's things, reasons why it should be a lower score. And it was the time of, us old-timers would know, Ann Gorsuch and Rita Lavelle, who were in charge of the EPA, and didn't really care quite as much as we'd like to have them care about some of the environmental issues. Anyhow, the score was lowered from 70-something to 60-something. It didn't matter in some ways because the company was already cooperating, and the 60-something was still a very high score. But just a bit of information there and interesting. As was mentioned, the big corporations, we got lots of good cooperation from them. And even when they weren't initially cooperative, even when they were very difficult, it usually lasted only so long. They could see the handwriting on the wall, and they had to do something about it. So in most cases, we were able to, with the big corporations, get cooperation. And in a number of cases, it was, you know, from the get-go that that was there. Oh, I left out that business with the difficult people. I think Steve was alluding to some of that there. We had some companies that they had staff there that were just ornery, outrageous just about. And especially sometimes there were attorneys, and Steve mentioned one of the attorneys at the Waste Disposal Engineering landfill, who really were puffed up and looking for a fight there. But even they eventually came to some sensible point in most cases. We had many early successes in the program, and I've mentioned those before there. FMC, Oakdale, even Ironwood. There were things that shouldn't have happened, you might say, in retrospect, but they did, and we did go ahead and work with the companies to do the cleanup. In the case of Oakdale, that was 3M was a major contributor. In the case of Ironwood, it was Philips, the electronics company out of, I think it's the Netherlands. You know, they make Norelco, Sonicare, et cetera, on light bulbs. And in the case of FMC, it was FMC Corporation, which I think was bought out by somebody else quite a number of years ago. But that was the FMC site, which was slash the Navy site. One other interesting bit there is the Boise Onan Medtronic court case. You know, you never want to get into a court case because it eats up huge amounts of time. And, you know, you don't know what's going to come out of it. This was a strange kind of situation, but one that was extremely successful in that the court upheld Superfund, and that meant you had smoother going after that, you know, withstood the legal challenges, so to speak. Actually, we weren't a party to that, except we were drug into it. Boise Cascade was a company that had bought a pole treating operation, operated for a while, closed it down, then sold it to Onan and Medtronic. And the court case really stuck it to Boise. It was kind of interesting why they brought up the case. But the companies, Onan and Medtronic, were cooperative, and the sites did have remedial action done at them. And it very much was a success for us in terms of the first court battle that was extremely successful. Couldn't be better. Going to end up with a couple of things in terms of that Superfund was the predecessor of brownfields. And we did a certain amount of sort of brownfields work even fairly early in the program. So Copper's Coke was one of them in on Energy Park Drive in St. Paul. And the Midway redevelopment around the university where Montgomery Wards used to be. We didn't give any kind of liability assurances, which is what people get if they cooperate with the agency on brownfields developments and if they're not a responsible party. But we did send what I call the logical sort of assurance or comfort kind of letters to people. So when they wanted to develop both of these sites, we indicated to them in a letter the steps that had been taken, if there were steps that had to be taken in the future, listed those out clearly. And a number of sites actually did go through development, even way back when. I also wanted to point out, and I'm not sure a number of other speakers will, that many of our sites have gone through redevelopment, and that includes those national priority list sites. And I think that's really feels like a great success when you can clean up or manage a site so well that you can actually develop it for useful purposes, put property to good use, employees, taxes, et cetera, at the same time that you're serving the environment. And I think sometimes the brownfields, the economic side of things, gives you that extra impetus for a company to move on cleanup. I'm going to mention Mack Hyde. Mack Hyde was an attorney for a number of responsible parties on many of the Superfund sites. He at some point either got tired of negotiating consent orders across the table from the PCA, or maybe he saw the great opportunity in terms of developing some of these sites. But anyhow, he had a number of sites. He had negotiated consent orders between companies he represented and the PCA. And eventually, some of these sites, I don't know if he bought it or he had partnership on some of these sites, but a number of these sites, he became a developer of them. And he sort of was the father of brownfields in some ways in Minnesota, or at least a major contributor to that. And so a couple examples of sites that were MPL sites that he helped to develop was National Lead in St. Louis Park and Joslin. I'm not sure where that is. It's a northwestern suburb. In addition, I think his firm, now headed by his son, Paul Hyde, I think is doing another one, FMC site. They're doing a redevelopment at that site. Last but not least, since Petrofund is my current program, I'll mention a little bit about that. Superfund, in a way, was the predecessor of Petrofund, but it really was a different kind of framework. And that's a site where there's about, that's a program where there's about 19,000 sites and huge numbers. You can't do it the same way that you would Superfund. In addition, many of these people were small kind of guys and gals, like mom and pa, we used to call them. And so there was a need to go ahead and create some kind of way of allowing them to move forward on those sites. And what came out of it was the Petrofund Law in 87, which provided dollars to responsible parties for doing investigations and cleanups. You can get as much as 90% reimbursement of the expenses for those things. Seemed kind of strange in some ways, but it actually got the job done. And if you had that kind of number of sites and did it all by enforcement, it would never happen. And it was funded by a 2 cent fee on each gallon of petroleum at the wholesale level. And that's had an awful lot of success, too, doing many of the same kind of things in the file analysis as Superfund. Now, my last slide.
Kind of running out of time.
Okay, my last slide. John stole everything from me. Actually, he didn't, but independently, we went ahead and talked about, I talk about now how stressful it was. But you know what really was exciting, as John mentioned? It was sort of the heyday for some of us there in terms of discovering new things, getting things done. And as strange as it may seem, John, I think, mentioned the word fun. Fun in quotation marks. It wasn't fun because of all the bad things that a Superfund site would be associated with, but it was fun in terms of all the energy and the excitement of getting the work done, learning how to do it, and then all the successes that came from that. So it was really quite the thrill for any number of us. I'm done.
Hey, well,